to see that he has done a good job, because he knows the furrow will yield a crop, in his case a crop of understanding. Does the writing hold up to his high standards? Is it true, clear, concise, final? He is catching up on his work. It is the last day of December of the year 1938, its final hours, in fact. A bleak Christmas has been dutifully celebrated, but otherwise he is in no mood for holiday festivities. His desk is covered with papers, some in clear view, others carefully, meaningfully eclipsed to varying degrees, depending on their importance, and still others that are ready to be filed away. His office is quiet, as is the hallway outside it. Braganza has a population of not 30,000 people, but its hospital, São Francisco, in which he is head pathologist, is the largest in Alto Douro. Other parts of the hospital will be lit up and swollen with bustle and noise, the emergency wing where people come in screaming and crying, the wards where the patients ring bells and hold the nurses up in endless conversations. But the pathology wing in the basement of the hospital, beneath all these lively floors, is typically hushed, like all pathology wings. He wishes it to stay that way. With the adding of three words and the crossing out of one, he completes the paragraph. He reads it over one last time. It is his private opinion that pathologists are the only physicians who know how to write. All the other devotees of Hippocrates hold up as their triumph the restored patient, and the words they might write, a diagnosis, a prescription, instructions for a treatment, are of fleeting interest to them. These physicians of restoration, as soon as they see a patient standing on his or her feet, move on to a new case. And it is true that everyday patients depart the hospital with quite a bounce to their step. Just an accident, or a little bout of this or that illness, they say to themselves. But Eusebio places greater store in those who were seriously sick. He notes in these patients leaving the hospital the tottering gait and the disheveled hair, the desperately humbled look, and the holy terror in their eyes. They know with inescapable clarity what is coming to them one day. There are many ways in which life's little candle can be snuffed out. A cold wind pursues us all, and when a stub of a candle is brought in, the wick blackened, the sides streaked with dripped wax, the attending physician, at the hospital São Francisco, in Bragança, Portugal at least, is either he or his colleague, Dr. José Otávio. Every dead body is a book with a story to tell. Each organ a chapter, the chapters united by a common narrative. It is Eusebio's professional duty to read these stories, turning every page with a scalpel, and at the end of each to write a book report. What he writes in a report must reflect exactly what he has read in the body. It makes for a hard-headed kind of poetry. Curiosity draws him on, like all readers. What happened to this body? How? Why? He searches for that crafty and forced absence that overtakes us all. What is death? There is the corpse, but that is the result, not the thing itself. When he finds a grossly enlarged lymph node or tissue that is abnormally rugose, he knows that he's hot on death's trail. How curious, though, death often comes disguised as life. A mass of exuberant anomalous cells, or, like a murderer, it leaves a clue, a smoking gun, the sclerotic caking of an artery, before fleeing the scene. Always he comes upon death's handiwork just as death itself has turned the corner, its hem disappearing with a quiet swish. He leans back in his chair to stretch. The chair creaks like old bones. He notices a file on his workbench along the wall where his microscope stands. What is it doing there? And what is that on the floor beneath the bench? Another file? And the glass on his desk? It's so dried out, it's collecting dust. He strongly believes in the importance of proper hydration. Life is moist. He should clean the glass and fill it with fresh, cool water. He shakes his head. Enough of these scattered thoughts. He has much that needs preserving, not only in solutions and slides, but in words. In each case he must bring together the patient's clinical history, the findings from the autopsy, and the histological results into a smooth and coherent whole. He must apply himself.
Focus, man, focus. Find the words.
Besides, there are other reports that need finishing. There is the one he has been putting off. It has to be done tonight. A body that was crushed and left for several days, half exposed to the air, half submerged in a river, inviting both rot and bloating. A loud rap at the door startles him. He looks at his watch. It is 10:30 at night.
Come in,
he calls out, exasperation escaping from his voice like steam from a kettle. No one enters, but he senses a brooding presence on the other side of the solid wood door.
I said, come in, he calls out again.
Still no rattling of the doorknob. Pathology is not a medical art that is much subject to emergency. The sick, or rather their biopsied samples, can nearly always wait till the next morning, and the dead are even more patient, so it's unlikely to be a clerk with an urgent case. And pathologists' offices are not located so that the general public might find them easily. Who then, at such an hour, on New Year's Eve at that, would wend their way through the basement of the hospital to look for him? He gets up, upsetting both himself and a number of papers. He walks around his desk, takes hold of the doorknob, and opens the door. A woman in her 50s, with lovely features and large brown eyes, stands before him. In one hand she is holding a bag. He is surprised to see her. She eyes him. In a warm, deep voice she starts up.
Why are you so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. I am poured out like water. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd. Oh, my darling, come quickly to my help.
While a small part of Eusebio sighs, a larger part smiles. The woman at the door is his wife. She comes to his office to see him on occasion, though not usually at such a late hour. Her name is Maria Luisa Motal Losora, and he is familiar with the words of her lament. They are taken mostly from Psalm 22, her favorite psalm. She, in fact, has no cause for conventional suffering. She is in good mental and physical health. She lives in a nice house. She has no desire to leave him or the town where they live. She has good friends. She is never truly bored. They have 3 grown children who are happy and healthy. In short, she has all the elements that make for a good life. Only his wife, his dear wife, is an amateur theologian, a priest manqué, and she takes the parameters of life, her mortal coildom, her jobdom, very seriously. She is fond of quoting from Psalm 22, especially its first line, my God, why have you forsaken me? His thought in response is that, nonetheless, there is my God at the start of the plaint. It helps that there's someone listening, if not doing. He has much listening to do, he does, with his wife, and not much doing. Her mouth might be dried up like a potsherd, but she never quotes the line that follows in Psalm 22, and my tongue sticks to my jaws, because that would be an untruth. Her tongue is never stuck to her jaws. Maria ardently believes in the spoken word. To her, writing is making stock and reading is sipping broth, but only the spoken word is the full roasted chicken. And so she talks. She talks all the time. She talks to herself when she is alone at home, and she talks to herself when she is alone on the street, and she has been talking to him incessantly since the day they met 38 years ago. His wife is an endlessly unfurling conversation with never a true stop, only a pause. but she produces no drivel and has no patience for drivel. Sometimes she chafes at the inane talk she has to endure with her friends. She serves them coffee and cake, she listens to their prattle, and later she grouses, "Guinea pigs! I am surrounded by guinea pigs!" He surmises that his wife read about guinea pigs and something about them aroused her resentment, their smallness, their utter harmlessness and defenselessness, their fearfulness, their contentedness simply to chew on a grain or two and expect no more from life. As a pathologist, he quite likes the guinea pig. It is indeed small in every way, especially when set against the stark and random cruelty of life. Every corpse he opens up whispers to him, "I am a guinea pig. Will you warm me to your breast?" Drivel, his wife would call that. She has no patience for death. When they were young, Maria tolerated for a while the amorous cooing of which he was so fond. Despite the surface brutality of his profession, he is soft of heart. When he met her the first time, it was in the cafeteria of the university, she was the most alluring creature he'd ever seen, a serious girl with a beauty that lit him up. At the sight of her, song filled his ears and the world glowed with color. His heart thumped with gratitude. But quickly she rolled her eyes and told him to stop twittering. It became clear to him that his mission was to listen to her and respond appropriately and not to annoy her with oral frivolity. She was the rich earth and the sun and the rain. He was merely the farmer who got the crop going. He was an essential but bit player, which was fine with him. He loved her then and he loves her now. She is everything to him. She is still the rich earth and the sun and the rain, and he is still happy to be the farmer who gets the crop going. Only tonight he had hoped to get some work done. Clearly that is not to be the case. The conversation is upon him.
"Hello, my angel," he says. "What a joyous surprise to see you. What's in the bag? You can't have been shopping. No shop would be open at this hour." He leans forward and kisses his wife. Maria ignores the question. "Death is a difficult door," she says quietly. She steps into his office. "Eusebio, what's happened?" she exclaimed. "Your office is an unholy mess. This is indecent. Where are your visitors supposed to sit?" He surveys his office. He sees embarrassing disorder everywhere. Pathologists at work don't normally receive visitors who need to sit or who care for order. They usually lie flat and without complaint on a table across the hallway. He takes his workbench chair and places it in front of his desk. "I wasn't expecting you tonight, my angel. Here, sit here," he says. "Thank you." She sits down and places the bag she brought with her on the floor. He gathers up papers from his desk, which he stuffs in the nearest folder, which he stacks on other folders, which he then drops to the floor. He pushes the pile under his desk with a foot out of sight. He crunches up stray bits of paper, sweeps up shameful accumulations of dust with the edge of his hand, using his other hand as a dustpan, which he empties into the waste paper basket beside his desk. "There, that's better." He sits down and looks across his desk at the woman sitting there, a man and his wife. "I have found the solution at last, and I must tell you about it," she says. "The solution? Was there a problem?" "Why don't you do that, then?" he replies. She nods. "I first tried through laughter, because you like to laugh," she says, without a trace of mirth. "You saw me. The books I was reading." He thinks. Yes, that would explain the selection of books she ordered from her favorite Coimbra bookseller these last several months. Some plays of Aristophanes, Shakespeare, Lope de Vega, Molière, Georges Feydeau, some weightier tomes of Boccaccio, Rabelais, Cervantes, Swift, Voltaire. All of these she read wearing the grimmest expression. He himself is not such an accomplished reader. He was not sure why she was reading these books, but, as always, he let her be. Humor and religion do not mix well,
she goes on. Humor may point out the many mistakes of religion, any number of vilely immoral priests or monsters who shed blood in the name of Jesus, but humor sheds no light on true religion. It's just humor unto itself. Worse, humor misunderstands religion, since there is little place for levity in religion, and let us not make the mistake of thinking that levity is the same thing as joy. Religion abounds in joy. Religion is joy. To laugh at religion with levity, then, is to miss the point, which is fine if one is in the mood to laugh, but not if one is in the mood to understand. Do you follow me?
Though it's late, I think I do, he replies.
Next, I tried children's books, Eusebio. Did Jesus not say that we must receive the kingdom of God like a little child? So I reread the books we used to read to Renato, Luisa, and Anton. Images of their three children when they were small appear in his mind. Those little ones lived with their mother's volubility like children live in a rainy climate. They just ran out to play in the puddles, shrieking and laughing, heedless of the downpour. She never took umbrage at these joyous interruptions. With difficulty, he returns his attention to his wife. These books brought back many happy memories, and some sadness that our children are all grown up, but they brought no religious illumination. I continued my search. Then the solution appeared right in front of me with your favorite writer.
Really? How interesting. When I saw your nose in those Agatha Christies, I thought you were taking a break from your arduous studies.
He and she are devoted to Agatha Christie. They have read all her books, starting with the very first, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. Thanks to the good works of the Círculo Portugués de Misterio, they receive her every new murder mystery the moment it is translated, and translation is prompt because Portuguese readers are eager. Husband and wife know better than to bother the other when one of them is absorbed in the latest arrival. Once they've both finished it, they go over the case together, discussing the clues they should have caught and the avenues to the solution they ran down, only to find they were dead ends. Agatha Christie's star detective is Hercule Poirot, a vain, odd-looking little Belgian man. But Poirot, inside his egg-shaped head, has the quickest, most observant mind. His gray cells, as he calls his brain, work with order and method, and these cells perceive what no one else does. Death on the Nile was such a marvel of ingenuity. Her next book must be due soon, he says.
It must.
And what solution did you find in Agatha Christie?
Let me first explain the path I have taken, she replies.
This path twists and turns, so you must listen carefully. Let us start with the miracles of Jesus. The miracles of Jesus, one of her favorite topics. He glances at the clock next to his microscope. The night is going to be long.
Is something the matter with your microscope? His wife asks.
Not at all. Peering through it won't help you understand the miracles of Jesus.
That is true.
And staring at the clock won't save you from your future.
True again.
Are you thirsty? Can I offer you water before we start?
Water from that glass?
She peers critically at the filthy glass on his desk.
I propose to clean it.
That would be a good idea. I'm fine for the moment, though. But how appropriate that you should mention water. We shall come back to water. Now, pay attention. The miracles of Jesus, so many of them are there not. And yet, if we look closely, we can see that they fall into two categories. Into one category fall those miracles that benefit the human body. There are many of these. Jesus makes the blind see, the deaf hear, the dumb speak, the lame walk. He cures fevers, treats epilepsy, exorcises psychological maladies. He rids lepers of their disease. A woman suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years touches his cloak and her bleeding stops. And of course he raises the dead, Jairus' daughter and the widow of Nain's only son, both freshly dead, but also Lazarus, who has been dead for 4 days and whose body stinks of death. We might call these the medical miracles of Jesus, and they represent the overwhelming majority of his miraculous work. Eusebio remembers the autopsy he performed earlier today, speaking of bodies that stink of death. The mushy, puffy body of a floater is an abhorrence to the eyes and to the nose, even when these are trained. But there are other miracles that benefit the human body besides the medical miracles, his wife continues. Jesus makes the nets of fishermen bulge with catch. He multiplies fish and loaves of bread to feed thousands. At Cana, he turns water into wine. In alleviating hunger and quenching thirst, Jesus again benefits the human body. So too, when he stills a storm that is swamping the boat his disciples are traveling in and rescues them from drowning, and the same when he gets Peter to pay the temple tax with the coin from the fish's mouth. In doing that, he saves Peter from the beating he would have endured had he been arrested. Maria has benefited his body, Eusebio muses, as he has hers. To love and then to have a fun time of it, is there any greater joy? They were like birds in springtime. Their carnal relations settled over the years, but the satisfaction has remained, the comfort of a sturdy, warm nest. Renewed love for Maria flames within him. When they met, she never told him that her name was Legion, that teeming within her were all the prophets and apostles of the Bible, besides a good number of the church fathers. When she was giving birth to their children, with each one the ordeal began with something like a plate breaking inside her, she said. Even then, as he sat in the waiting room listening to her panting and groaning and shrieking, she discoursed on religion. The doctor and the nurses came out with thoughtful expressions. He had to remind them to tell him about the new baby. Even as she suffered and they worked, she caused them to think. How did he end up with a wife who was both beautiful and profound? Did he deserve such luck? He smiles and winks at his wife. Eusebio, stop it. Time is short, she whispers. Now, why does Jesus benefit the human body? Of course he does his miracle work to impress those around him, and they are impressed. They're amazed. But to show that he is the Messiah, why does Jesus cure infirmities and feed hungry stomachs? After all, he could also soar like a bird, as the devil asked him to do, or, as he himself mentioned, he could go about casting mountains into seas. These too would be miracles worthy of a Messiah. Why body miracles? Eusebio remains hushed. He's tired. Worse, he's hungry. He remembers the bag at his wife's feet. Perhaps he should wash the glass in the small sink in his office and, when returning to his desk, try to glimpse inside the bag. She usually brings him something to eat when she visits. His wife answers her question. Jesus performs these miracles because they bring relief where we want it most. We all suffer in our bodies and die. It is our fate, as you well know, my dear, spending your days cutting up human carrion. In curing and feeding us, Jesus meets us at our weakest. He eases us of our heavy burden of mortality, and that impresses us more deeply than any other display of mighty power, be it flying in the air or throwing mountains into seas. Now, to the second category of the miracles of Jesus, the category of the miracle of interpretation. This category contains only a single miracle. Do you know what that miracle is? Tell me, Eusebio says softly. It is when Jesus walks on the water. There is no other miracle like it. Jesus tells his disciples to get into the boat and travel on ahead. They set out while Jesus goes onto the mountain to pray. The day ends. The disciples strain at their oars against a strong wind, but there is no storm. Their bodies are not in any danger. After a long night of toil, as the new day is starting, they see Jesus coming towards their boat, walking on the sea. They are terrified. Jesus reassures them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Matthew, in his version of the story, has Peter ask the Lord if he can join him. "Come," says Jesus. Peter gets out of the boat and walks on the water towards Jesus, but then the wind frightens him and he begins to sink. Jesus reaches out with his hand and brings Peter back to the boat. The adverse wind ceases. Why would Jesus walk on water? Did he do it to save a drowning soul, to benefit a human body? No. Peter got into trouble in the water after Jesus began walking on it. Was there some other impetus? Jesus started his miraculous walk very early in the morning, from remote shores, alone, and at sea he was seen by no one but his disciples, who were out of sight of land. In other words, there was no social necessity to the miracle. Walking on water did no one any particular good, raised no specific hopes. It was neither asked for, nor expected, nor even needed. Why such an anomalous miracle in documents as spare and winnowed as the Gospels? And this unique miracle can't be hidden away. It appears in two of the synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Mark, and in John, one of the very few crossover miracles. What does it mean, Eusebio? What does it mean? In a moment of clarity, I saw. He perks up. It always goes like this. She talks and talks and talks, and then suddenly he is hooked, like a fish in a biblical story. What did she see? I saw that the miracle of Jesus walking on the water means little when taken at face value. However, when it is taken as saying one thing, but implying another, in other words, as allegory, then the miracle opens up. Swimming is a modern invention. People at the time of Jesus could not swim. If they fell into deep water, they sank and they drowned. That is the literal truth. But if we think of water as the experience of life, it is also the religious truth. Men and women are weak, and in their weakness they sink. Jesus does not sink. A man drowning in water naturally looks up. What does he see? While he is being engulfed by choking darkness, he sees above him the clear light and pure air of salvation. He sees Jesus, who stands above those struggling in weakness, offering them redemption. This explains Peter's hapless performance on the water. He is only human, and therefore he begins to sink. Read so, as an allegory about our weakness and Jesus' purity, and the salvation that he offers, the miracle takes on a whole new meaning. Now, I asked myself, why would this miracle demand an allegorical reading but not the others? Would the miracles that benefit the human body gain from a similar reading? I had never thought of that. Poor stupid woman that I am, I had always taken the body miracles of Jesus as factual truth. In my mind, Jesus really did cure leprosy, blindness, and other ailments and infirmities, and he really did feed the thousands. But is the Lord to be reduced to an itinerant doctor and a peddler of buns? I don't think so. The miracles that benefit the human body must also mean something greater. What? Eusebio asks pliantly. Well, what else could they be but symbols of the everlasting kingdom? Each miraculous cure of Jesus is a glimpse of the ultimate place that is ours if we have faith. Have faith and you will be cured of your mortality. You will be fed forever. Do you understand the import of what I am saying? Eusebio ventures a nod. Maria's voice is warm, buttery, comforting. If only he could eat it. He peeks at the clock. The miracle of Jesus walking on the water is a guide to how we must read Scripture as a whole. The Gospels are lesser, their message weakened, if we read them as though they are reports by four journalists. But if we understand them as written in the language of metaphors and symbols, then they open up with moral depth and truth. That is the language used by Jesus himself, is it not? How did he teach the people? It says in the Gospels, he did not speak to them except in parables.
That's right, the parable of the lost sheep, of the mustard seed, of the fig tree, of the yeast, of the sower, of the prodigal son, and so on. So many parables.
Mutton with mustard sauce, with stewed figs and a glass of wine. So many edible parables, thinks Eusebio.
A parable is an allegory in the form of a simple story. It is a suitcase that we must open and unpack to see its contents. And the single key that unlocks these suitcases, that opens them wide, is allegory. Finally, only one miracle stands true and literal, the pillar of our faith, his resurrection. Once that is clear, we can start making sense of all the stories told by Jesus and told about him. That is Christianity at heart, a single miracle surrounded and sustained by stories, like an island surrounded by the sea.
Eusebio coughs a little.
You haven't been sharing these insights with Father Cecilio, have you?
Father Cecilio is their local priest, and the subject of much eye-rolling on Maria's part. In her presence, the poor man always looks like the chicken in the coop that hasn't laid enough eggs.
What, and have us excommunicated? That dimwit is the very hammer of literalism that insults my faith. He's as dumb as an ox.
But he means well, Eusebio suggests soothingly,
as does an ox.
That's all very interesting, what you've been saying.
I'm not finished. I was searching, if you remember. There's a problem.
Yes, and you found a solution.
Oh, how my heart beats! I'll drink now, if you sanitize that glass.
Maria bends down and produces from the bag a bottle of red wine, which she places on the desk. Eusebio cracks a wide smile.
Maria, bless you!
He hurries to open the bottle. While it breathes, he washes the glass thoroughly.
I don't have another glass, he says. You drink from it, and I'll drink from the bottle.
That's unseemly. We'll share the glass.
All right.
He tips some of the elixir into the glass. It glows like a firefly. He licks his lips at the prospect of pouring it down his throat, but offers the glass to his wife.
You first, my angel.
Maria takes a small, thoughtful sip. She closes her eyes as she considers its distilled effect on her. She purrs and opens her eyes.
It's a good one.
She passes him the glass. He takes a larger sip, grunts with pleasure, empties the glass in one go.
Ooh, indeed, just a little more.
He half fills the glass, perhaps a little more than half. Maria has another sip.
That'll be enough for me, she says. Happy New Year.
Sorry?
What's the point of looking at a clock if you don't notice the time? Look at the two hands. It's midnight. We're now in 1939.
You're right. Happy New Year to you, my angel. May this year be a good one.
He finishes off the glass and sits down again. Now it is his turn to glow like a firefly, and his mind flits about inconsequentially as his wife starts up again.
Why would Jesus speak in parables? Why would he both tell stories and let himself be presented through stories? Why would truth use the tools of fiction?
Stories full of metaphors are by writers who play the language like a mandolin for our entertainment, novelists, poets, playwrights, and other crafters of inventions. Meanwhile, isn't it extraordinary that there are no significant historical accounts of Jesus of Nazareth?
A minor government official from Lisbon comes to Braganza, a tight little man with nothing to say, and it's all over the papers, which end up in archives for the rest of time. Or you, your work, Eusebio. Someone does that ordinary thing of dying, and you write a report. You immortalize that ordinary mortal. Meanwhile, the Son of God comes to town. He travels around. He meets anyone and everyone. He impresses mightily. He is murdered, and no one writes about it. Of this great divine comet hitting the earth, the only impact is a swirl of oral tales.
There are hundreds of documents from pagan authors from the first century of our Christian era. Jesus is not mentioned in a single one. No contemporary Roman figure, no official, no general, no administrator, no historian, no philosopher, no poet, no scientist, no merchant, no writer of any sort mentions him. Not the least reference to him is to be found on any public inscription or in any surviving private correspondence. He left behind no birth record, no trial report, no death certificate. A century after his death, 100 years, there are only 2 pagan references to Jesus, one from Pliny the Younger, a Roman senator and writer, the other from Tacitus, a Roman historian. A letter and a few pages, that's all, from the zealous bureaucrats and the proud administrators of an empire whose next religion was founded on Jesus, whose capital would become the capital of his cult. The pagans didn't notice the man who would transform them from Romans into Christians. That seems as unlikely as the French not noticing the French Revolution. If Jews of the day had more to say about Jesus, it's been lost. There is nothing from any of the Pharisees who conspired against him, nothing from the Sanhedrin, the religious council that condemned him. The historian Josephus makes 2 brief references to Jesus, but many decades after his crucifixion. The entire historical record on Jesus of Nazareth from non-Christian sources fits into a handful of pages, and it's all second-hand. None of it tells us anything we don't already know from Christian sources. No, no, no. The historical record is of no help. Our knowledge of the flesh and blood Jesus all comes down to 4 allegorists. Even more astonishing, these word minstrels never met Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, whoever they were, weren't eyewitnesses. Like the Romans and Jews, they wrote about Jesus years after his passage on earth. They were inspired scribes who recorded and arranged oral tales that had been circulating for decades. Jesus has come to us, then, through old stories that survived mostly by word of mouth. What a casual, risky way of making one's mark on history. Stranger still, it's as if Jesus wanted it that way. Jews are obsessively literate. A Jew's every finger is a pen. God merely speaks to the rest of us, while Jews get handed inscribed stone tablets. Yet here was an important Jew who preferred the wind to the written word, who chose the eddying of oral tales over the recorded facts. Why this approach? Why not impose himself like the great military messiah Jews were hoping for? Why storytelling over history-making? His wife has led him down one grand corridor after another. Now Eusebio senses they are about to enter the ballroom, with its vast dancing floor and glittering chandeliers and high windows. I think it's because once more Jesus seeks to benefit us. A story is a wedding in which we listeners are the groom watching the bride coming up the aisle. It is together in an act of imaginary consummation that the story is born. This act wholly involves us, as any marriage would, and just as no marriage is exactly the same as another, so each of us interprets a story differently, feels for it differently. A story calls upon us as God calls upon us, as individuals, and we like that. Stories benefit the human mind. Jesus trod the earth with the calm assurance that he would stay with us and we would stay with him so long as he touched us through stories, so long as he left a fingerprint upon our startled imagination. And so he came not charging on a horse, but quietly riding a story. Imagine, Eusebio, that you've been invited to a feast, and a splendid table has been presented to you with the finest wines and the most delicious food. You eat and you drink till you are full.
Would you then turn to your host and ask about the barn animals you've eaten? You might, and you might get some information about these animals, but what does it compare to the feast you've just had? We must abandon this reductionist quest for the historical Jesus. He won't be found because that's not where, that's not how he chose to make his mark. Jesus told stories and lived through stories. Our faith is faith in his story, and there is very little beyond that story faith. The Holy Word is story, and story is the Holy Word.
Maria breathes deeply. A smile lights up her face.
Well, stories are still with us. And so I come to the solution, to Agatha Christie.
She leans over and brings up from the bag at her feet handfuls of books with which Eusebio is familiar. The Man in the Brown Suit, The Mystery of the Blue Train, The Seven Dials Mystery, The Murder at the Vicarage, Why Didn't They Ask Evans, Three-Act Tragedy, Murder in Mesopotamia, Death on the Nile, The Mysterious Mr. Quinn, The ABC Murders, Lord Edgware Dies, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, The 13 Problems, The Hound of Death, The Sittaford Mystery, Murder on the Orient Express, Dumb Witness, Peril at End House. They all end up on his desk. So many brightly jacketed hardcovers, except for a few that fall with a thud to the floor. The thought first struck me as I was rereading Murder on the Orient Express. I noticed how the train comes from the east. There are 13 passengers at the heart of the story, one of whom is a monster, a Judas. I noticed how these passengers come from all walks of life and all nationalities. I noticed how one of the investigators, a helper of Hercule Poirot, is a Dr. Constantine. Isn't the story of Jesus an Eastern story made popular by another Constantine? Did Jesus not have 12 disciples with a Judas among them? Was Palestine not a mixed Orient Express of nationalities? The foreignness of Hercule Poirot is often remarked upon. Time and again he saves the day. The foreigner whose intervention is salvific, isn't that one way of seeing Jesus? These observations led me to examine the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie in a new light. I began to notice things in a jumble. There is meaning in every small incident. Agatha Christie's stories are narratives of revelatory detail, hence the spare, direct language and the short, numerous paragraphs and chapters, as in the Gospels. Only the essential is recounted. Murder mysteries, like the Gospels, are distillations. I noticed the near total absence of children in Agatha Christie, because murder is a decidedly adult entertainment, just as they are largely absent from the Gospels, which also address an adult sensibility. I noticed how those who know the truth are always treated with suspicion and disdain. That was the case with Jesus, of course, but look at old Miss Marple. Always she knows, and everyone is surprised that she does. And the same with Hercule Poirot. How can that ridiculous little man know anything? But he does, he does. It is the triumph of the meek in Agatha Christie as in the Gospels. The gravest sin, the taking of a life, is always at the core of an Agatha Christie story, as it is at the core of the story of Jesus. In both narratives, numerous characters are briefly introduced and for the same purpose, the parading of all the suspects, so that the reader can see who gives in to the temptation of evil in contrast to who does not. Fortitude is set next to weakness, both in the Gospels and in Agatha Christie, and in both, the light of understanding comes in the same way. We are given facts, neutral in themselves, then we are given an interpretation that imprints meaning upon these facts.
So proceed the parables of Jesus, exposition, then explanation, and so proceeds the passion of Jesus. His death and resurrection were explained, given meaning to, by Paul after the fact. And so proceed the denouements of the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie. Hercule Poirot summarizes all the facts before he tells us what they mean. Notice the vital role of the witness. Neither Jesus nor Hercule Poirot cared to pick up a pen. Both were content to live in the spoken word. The act of witness was therefore a necessity. How else would we know what they said and did? But it was also a consequence. Each man in his own sphere did such amazing things that people felt compelled to bear witness. Those who met Jesus spent the rest of their lives talking about him to family, friends, and strangers, until what they said reached the ears of Paul, and later of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the same thing with Arthur Hastings, the Watson-like narrator of many of the Hercule Poirot stories, a narrator no less loyal than the narrators of the Gospels. But every witness is to some degree unreliable. We see that clearly with Arthur Hastings, who is always a few steps behind Hercule Poirot until Poirot helps him catch up with lucid explanations. We realize then that it is not only Arthur Hastings who is obtuse. We, too, have missed clues, misunderstood import, failed to seize the meaning. We, too, need Hercule Poirot to help us catch up. And so with Jesus. He was surrounded by so many Arthur Hastingses who were perpetually missing clues, misunderstanding import, failing to seize the meaning. He, too, had to explain everything to his disciples so that they might catch up. And still the disciples got it wrong. Still they couldn't agree on what Jesus said or did. Look at the Gospels. Four of them, each a little different from the others, each inconsistent with the others, as always happens with the testimony of witnesses. In an Agatha Christie mystery, the murderer is nearly always a figure closer than we expected. Remember The Man in the Brown Suit, and The Seven Dials Mystery, and Three-Act Tragedy, and The ABC Murders, and especially The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, to name just a few. Our vision of evil far away is acute, but the closer the evil, the greater the moral myopia. The edges become blurred, the center hard to see. Thus, the reaction when it is revealed who did it, et tu, Brute. The disciples must have reacted in this way when Judas, good Judas Iscariot, our dear friend and traveling companion, proved to be a traitor. How blind we are to evil close by, how willing to look away. Speaking of blindness, there is this curious phenomenon. We read Agatha Christie in the grip of compulsion. We must keep on reading. We want to know who did it and how and why. Then we find out. We're amazed at the complexity of the crime's execution. Oh, the coolness of the murderer's mind, the steadiness of his or her hand. Our devouring curiosity satisfied, we put the book down, and instantly we forget who did it. Isn't that so? We don't forget the victim. Agatha Christie can title her novels The Murder of Roger Ackroyd or Lord Edgware Dies without any fear of losing her reader's interest. The victim is a given, and he or she stays with us. But how quickly the murderer vanishes from our mind. We pick up an Agatha Christie murder mystery. She's written so many. And we wonder, have I read this one? Let me see. She's the victim, yes, I remember that, but who did it? Oh, I can't remember. We must reread 100 pages before we recall who it was that took a human life. We apply the same amnesia to the Gospels. We remember the victim, of course we do, but do we remember who killed him? If you went up to your average person on the street and said, "Quick, tell me, who murdered Jesus?" My guess is that the person would be at a loss for words. Who did murder Jesus of Nazareth? Who was responsible? Judas Iscariot? Bah! He was a tool, an accessory. He betrayed Jesus. He gave him up to people who sought him, but he did not kill him.
Pontius Pilate, then, the Roman procurator who sentenced him to death? Hardly. He just went along. He found Jesus innocent of any wrongdoing, sought to have him released, preferred to have Barabbas crucified, and yielded only in the face of the angry crowd. Pilate chose to sacrifice an innocent man rather than have a riot on his hands. So he was a weak man, another accessory to murder, but he was not the actual murderer. Who, then, did the deed? The Romans, more generally? Jesus was strung up by Roman soldiers following Roman orders according to Roman law in a Roman province. But who's ever heard of such a nebulous murderer? Are we to accept theologically that the Son of God was murdered by the nameless servants of a long-vanished empire to appease a squabbling local tribe? If that's the case, no wonder no one can remember who did it. Ah, but of course, it was Jews who murdered Jesus. That's a familiar refrain, is it not? A group of manipulative Jewish elders, in collusion with the Roman authorities, conspired to get rid of a troublesome fellow Jew. And we remembered to hate Jews but not Italians. How did that happen? The shame of it. But if it was Jews who were responsible, which ones? What were their names? We have Caiaphas, the high priest. Any others? None who is named. And really, like Judas, like Pilate, Caiaphas was an accessory. Jews could not openly kill a Jew. Remember the Ten Commandments? Caiaphas had to find others who would do it. So he and his fellow elders whipped up the crowd, and it's the crowd that decided matters against Jesus. With them lies the true, practical guilt. If the crowd had cried for Jesus' release and Barabbas' crucifixion, Pilate would have obliged. Caiaphas would have been stymied, and Judas would have had to return his blood money. There we seem to have it, then. It was a crowd that was responsible for the murder of Jesus of Nazareth. To put it in exact terms, a crowd framed by mostly anonymous officials, manipulated by mostly anonymous elders, wished him dead. And then anonymous soldiers actually killed him. But it started with a crowd, and is there anything more anonymous than a crowd? Is a crowd not by definition anonymous? From this assessment, it's clear. These guilty Jews, these guilty Romans, they are straw men, red herrings, in the best tradition of Agatha Christie. No wonder the common brutish mind thinks it's the Jew next door who murdered Jesus. That's more concrete. But in theological actuality, it was Anonymous who killed Jesus of Nazareth. And who is Anonymous? Maria stops. After some seconds of silence, Eusebio realizes with a start that his wife is waiting for him to answer the question. Oh, I'm not sure. I've never... Anonymous is you, is me, is all of us. We murdered Jesus of Nazareth. We are the crowd. We are Anonymous. It is not the guilt of Jews that goes down through history. It is the guilt of all of us. But how quick we are to forget that. We don't like guilt, do we? We prefer to hide it, to forget it, to twist it and present it in a better light, to pass it on to others. And so, because of our aversion to guilt, we strain to remember who killed the victim in the Gospels, as we strain to remember who killed the victim in an Agatha Christie murder mystery. And at the end of it, is that not the plainest way to describe the life of Jesus as a murder mystery? A life was taken, the victim completely innocent. Who did it? Who had the motive and the opportunity? What happened to the body? What did it all mean? An exceptional detective was needed to solve the crime, and he came along some years after the murder, the Hercule Poirot of the first century, Paul of Tarsus. Christianity starts with Paul. The earliest Christian documents are his letters. With them we have the story of Jesus, years before the life of Jesus of the Gospels. Paul vowed to get to the bottom of the Jesus affair. Using his gray cells, he sleuthed about, listening to testimony, poring over the record of events, gathering clues, studying every detail. He had a big break in the case in the form of a vision on the road to Damascus. And at the end of his investigation, he drew the only conclusion possible. Then he preached and he wrote, and Jesus went from being a failed Messiah to the resurrected Son of God who takes on our burden of sins. Paul closed the case on Jesus of Nazareth. And just as the resolution of the crime in an Agatha Christie brings on a sort of glee, and the reader is struck by her amazing ingenuity, so the resurrection of Jesus and its meaning induces a powerful glee in the Christian. More, a lasting joy. And the Christian thanks God for his amazing ingenuity as well as his boundless compassion. Because the resurrection of Jesus to wash away our sins is the only possible solution to the problem as understood by Paul, the problem of a loving God unexpectedly put to death who then resurrects. Hercule Poirot would heartily approve of the logic of Paul's solution. The world of the Gospels is stark. There is much suffering in it. Suffering of the body, suffering of the soul. It is a world of moral extremes in which the good are purely good and the evil insistently evil. Agatha Christie's world is equally stark. Who among us lives a life so beset by murders as Hercule Poirot and Jane Marple? And behind these murders, so much conniving evil. Our world is not like that, is it? Most of us know neither so much good nor so much evil. We sail a tempered middle. And yet murders happen, sometimes on a large scale, do they not? The Great War ended not so long ago. Next door, the Spaniards are killing each other with abandon. And now there are insistent rumors of another war across our continent. The symbolic crime of our century is the murder, Eusebio. Anonymous is still very much with us. That tempered middle we sail is an illusion. Our world is stark, too, but we hide in a shelter built of luck and closed eyes. What will you do when your luck runs out, when your eyes are ripped open? The sad fact is that there are no natural deaths, despite what doctors say. Every death is felt by someone as a murder, as the unjust taking of a loved being. And even the luckiest of us will encounter at least one murder in our lives, our own. It is our fate. We all live a murder mystery of which we are the victim. The only modern genre that plays on the same high moral register as the Gospels is the lowly regarded murder mystery. If we set the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie atop the Gospels and shine a light through, we see correspondence and congruence, agreement and equivalence. We find matching patterns and narrative similarities. They are maps of the same city, parables of the same existence. They glow with the same moral transparency. And so the explanation for why Agatha Christie is the most popular author in the history of the world. Her appeal is as wide and her dissemination as great as the Bible's, because she is a modern apostle, a female one, about time, after 2,000 years of men blathering on. And this new apostle answers the same questions Jesus answered. What are we to do with death? Because murder mysteries are always resolved in the end, the mystery neatly dispelled, we must do the same with death in our lives. Resolve it, give it meaning, put it into context, however hard that might be. And yet Agatha Christie and the Gospels are different in a key way. We no longer live in an age of prophecy and miracle. We no longer have Jesus among us the way people of the Gospels did. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are narratives of presence. Agatha Christie's are Gospels of absence. They are modern Gospels for a modern people, a people more suspicious, less willing to believe. And so Jesus is present only in fragments, in traces, cloaked and masked, obscured and hidden. But look!
He's right there, in her last name. Mainly, though, he hovers, he whispers.
A smile creeps across Maria Losora's face as she watches for his reaction. He smiles back, but stays silent. If he is honest, it is jarring to hear Jesus Christ and Agatha Christie, the Apostle Paul and Hercule Poirot, so closely matched. The Pope in Rome will not be pleased to hear that he has a serious rival in the form of a 48-year-old woman from Torquay, England, the author of many highly engaging entertainments. Maria speaks again, her gentle voice coming like an embrace.
That's the great enduring challenge of our modern times, is it not? To marry faith and reason. So hard, so unreasonable, to root our lives upon a distant wisp of holiness. Faith is grand, but impractical. How does one live an eternal idea in a daily way? It's so much easier to be reasonable. Reason is practical, its rewards are immediate, its workings are clear. But alas, reason is blind. Reason on its own leads us nowhere, especially in the face of adversity. How do we balance the two? How do we live with both faith and reason? In your case, Eusebio, I thought the solution would be stories that put reason on brilliant display while also keeping you close to Jesus of Nazareth. That way you can hold on to your faith should it ever waver, and so I give to you Agatha Christie. She is radiant. Her two-word gift, wrapped in spools of speech, is now in his lap. From decades of experience, he knows that his turn to intervene has come. But he is unexpectedly tongue-tied. What? The miracles of Jesus? Jesus benefiting the human body? Jesus walking on water? Jesus the allegorist saved by other allegorists? Jesus the victim in a murder mystery? Jesus a whispering background character in Agatha Christie? All that winding argumentation so that he might read his favorite writer with greater religious comfort? He stumbles his way to words. Thank you, Maria. I've never thought of Agatha Christie in this way. I love you, his wife interrupts him, and I've done this for you. All you ever read is Agatha Christie. Next time you're at home sick with sadness, pick up one of her books and imagine you're in a boat. Standing on the water alongside the boat is Jesus of Nazareth. He begins to read the Agatha Christie to you. The warm breath of God, who loves you, comes off the page and touches your face. How can you not smile then?
Why, Maria, he cries.
What is this stammer that is suddenly afflicting him? He looks at her and is reminded of that for which he is grateful, the rich earth and the sun and the rain and the crops.
My angel, it's so kind of you. I'm truly thankful.
He stands and moves around the desk towards her. She also gets to her feet. He takes her in his arms. They kiss. She is cold. He holds her tighter to warm her with his body. He speaks into her shoulder.
It's a wonderful gift. I'm so lucky to have...
She pulls back and pats his cheek.
You're welcome, my dear husband. You're welcome. You're a good man.
She sighs. I should be getting home. Can you help me put the books back in the bag, please?
Of course.
He bends down to pick up the volumes that fell to the floor. Together they fill the bag with all the Agatha Christies and walk the few steps to the door of his office. He opens the door.
You left the milk out, she says on the threshold. For 3 days. It's gone bad. It stinks.
I didn't notice since I never drink the stuff. If you're going to work all night, get some fresh milk on your way home. And buy bread. Make sure you don't get lentil bread. It gives you gas. And lastly, I've brought you a little gift. Don't look now. I'm leaving.
but still he wants to hold her back, to thank her for the gift of her, his dear wife of 38 years. Still he wants to say things to her. "Shall we pray?" he asks, typically a good way to stop his wife in her tracks. "I'm too tired, but you pray, and you have work to do. What are you working on?"
He looks at his desk.
His work?
He'd forgotten all about his work.
"I have a number of reports to write up. One case is particularly unpleasant, a woman who was pushed off a bridge, a wicked murder."
He sighs. "Only the autopsies of babies and children are worse, all those toy organs. Otherwise, there is no greater abomination than the decomposed human body. 2 or 3 days after death, the putrefying body manifests a greenish patch on the abdomen, which spreads to the chest and to the upper thighs. This green tinge is the result of a gas produced by bacteria in the intestinal system."